This shiur has been brought to you from the Sharim Audio Library. For information about Sharim or to order additional CDs, please visit our website www.sharim.com or email sharim@sharim.com. Thank you for making Sharim part of your continual learning experience.
The Romans, they didn't have a nationalistic type of motivation. Their motivation was because they were doing it in order to be able to preserve their right to observe these most elementary mitzvahs, and they had actually remarkable success. And what happened was they finally came together under the command of a man called Shimon ben Kosiba. Shimon ben Kosiba, and he was a man, truth is, he was a very righteous person, and he was a very, very unique person. He organized these groups together, and he became their leader. And he was so, his success was so astonishing, so remarkable, that Rabbi Akiva was actually, we discussed at length, and we're going to mention him again today, Rabbi Akiva, who was the leading sage of the generation, Rabbi Akiva actually, it says in the Midrash, was convinced that he was the Mashiach. He was convinced that he was, and he, as a matter of fact, there's a pasuk in Parashas Balak, that says, which describes when the Mashiach comes, and the pasuk says, Dorach, Krechav v'Yakov, and a star will spin out, will come out, a shooting star will come out of Yaakov, and that is reference to Mashiach. And because of this, Rabbi Akiva, instead of calling him Bar Kosiba, he referred to him as Bar Kochba, the son of a star. Okay? And this explains why we've explained before that the sages had a tradition not to rebel against the Romans. Okay, we saw it was a few weeks ago in the Midrashim. There's a number of Midrashim where this is an ancient tradition that they had not to rebel against the Romans. But here it was different because, in this case, according to the way Rabbi Akiva saw things, if Bar Kochba is in fact the Mashiach, then the time has come. And that's why he supported it. The Midrash describes the most amazing feats of heroism and strength, supernatural feats that Bar Kochba did. And so therefore Rabbi Akiva was actually convinced that he was the Mashiach. As a matter of fact, these organized groups led by Bar Kochba were so successful that he began a revolt. It was in 126, if you want to know what we're talking about. And within 3 years, he succeeded in capturing Yerushalayim. He recaptured Yerushalayim. We mentioned before the Romans turned Yerushalayim into a completely non-Jewish city, forbidding Jews even to come in. And they built a pagan temple on the southern side of the temple. They came in, he recaptured Yerushalayim. The Romans were forced to withdraw to Caesarea. And the majority of Judea actually then became under Jewish rule. And wouldn't you know it, for 2.5 full years, it was a full-fledged, independent Jewish commonwealth. Okay? Under the leader of Bar Kochba. So what you've got is this remarkable situation. Coming only half a century after the destruction of the temple, the Jewish people were completely decimated. And then within just 50-odd years, a little bit more, top more, they had actually got to a situation right now where they could actually successfully raise, because of this resistance to Shnat, by the way, this is the reason why they were so successful. In other words, if the Jewish people would just rebel against the Romans because of their oppressiveness or because of their taxes, they probably just would have gripped their teeth and bared it. But since the Romans were raising their hands against the Torah, and the keeping of the Torah, so this evoked a very deep reaction of the Jewish people. This produced a very extraordinary leader called Bar Kochba. He's not going to last too long, we'll soon see, who has the backing of the great sage Rabbi Akiva. And for actually 2.5 years, Judea is going to be independent again. We're going to see that later on, actually, the city, the residents of a famous city called Beitar, they built it in the original place, not far from there, but they actually crowned him the king of the Jewish people. Okay? So this was Bar Kochba. At this stage, things were quite extraordinary. By the way, if you want to know just what Bar Kochba was like, it says, the Gemara says, the Medrash says, that the Bar Kochba had a retinue of 400,000 soldiers. 400,000 soldiers. Now listen to the requirements if you want to get a position in Bar Kochba's army. It says, first of all, I'll just say the words and then I'll tell you what they mean. It says, there were 200,000 who were missing their thumbs, and 200,000 who were capable of uprooting cedar trees. What does this mean, they were missing thumbs? Listen to this. Everyone get ready to cringe. It says, if you want to prove how brave you were, in the first one they were doing the original pruning, if you want to prove how brave and fearless you were to get a position in Bar Kokhba's army, the person had to bite off his thumb with his teeth. That's why they were called Kitsetsi Boemis. They were called people, yeah? That's how they showed their, okay? It wasn't my idea. It wasn't my idea. He was a righteous person. But we'll see. He went off. Bar Kokhba went off. Okay? But you say that. And then it says over here that the sages objected to this process. You happy to hear that?
Yes.
So the criteria now, after that, to be able to be accepted into Bar Kokhba's army was that a person had to be able to uproot a cedar tree while he was riding on a horse at a full gallop. In other words, he had to be galloping along a horse. He had to be able to, he had to have that kind of kvura, that kind of might, that kind of strength, that at a full gallop on a horse, you can gallop and you can pull up a cedar tree. Okay? So this was, okay, so it says like this. Bar Kokhba had 400,000 of these. It was quite something. Now, the truth is, I'll tell you, I don't know exactly if these numbers, all of these numbers in Midrashim, I don't know if we're meant to take them exactly literally, or not. We're going to see today that some of the numbers are, it's almost, if they cannot be meant literally, but we're going to see that Bar Kokhba certainly unleashed a very, very major force and was very, very successful. If you want to see just some proof of that, the Romans realized that this situation was very serious because, you know, if they're holding together a whole empire, and if a group of Jews actually can dislodge them, this is actually a threat to the entire empire. So Hadrian sent into Eretz Yisrael a total of 8 Roman legions. Now that number may not impress you, 8 Roman legions. But if you want to know, when the Romans 50 years earlier destroyed the temple, they did it with 3 legions. They sent 3 legions, and here they obviously ran the threat so great that they sent 8 full legions, nearly 3 times the number. This must have been hundreds of thousands of Roman soldiers with Hadrian personally in command, okay, to come along to crush the Jewish rebellion. Okay? Now, even though it wasn't necessarily so successful at the beginning, there was one encounter, and one entire Roman legion was actually completely destroyed. In other words, these Jews, they possessed it. You have to understand one thing. Jews are not pacifists. We have certain traditions in certain what we call like Kabbalah, a tradition. In certain cases, we're not supposed to resist. But we find in all cases when Jews actually took up their weapons of war, they were uniquely powerful. Especially we find this where they were taking up weapons in order to defend their connection with Torah and mitzvahs, where they were unique. There are three things which are called az. Az means like intense things. One of them is the Jewish people. They're called az bu'umis, the most intense of all the nations in the world. Okay? They possess a certain locked up power. And when it's released in a certain way, it comes out with absolutely formidable results. So this is what happened with Bar Kokhba, and he actually pitted right now for a major confrontation with the Roman Empire, and he had actually quite some major successes. But of course, it's not going to last. Yeah. The other two is one is going with the Kohanim, and I can't remember the other one right now. It's called the Kohanim, called Azim, and I can't remember. I'll have a look. Okay, lean it after. So embarrassed that I don't remember. As soon as I finish the class, I'm going to take out a Gemara and look it up. Read it. Okay? All right. But the Jewish people maintain this special, they have this power. By the way, you see this in the Gemara. On that same Gemara, you should know, the Gemara says, it's called Oz. Oz means Ayin Zayin. It's powerful. Brazen. So the Torah is also called Oz. Hashem Oz Le'amo Yitin. Hashem gave this powerhouse to Hashem called the Torah. The Gemara says, that same Gemara says that the Torah actually weakens a person's It says that if Hashem hadn't given us the Torah, we would just destroy the whole world. We put our powers into the Torah. And by the way, if you don't believe that, just take a look at a newspaper. Okay? The Jews are like triggering off everything. Wherever there's something going on in the world, Jews are triggering it off. Right? That's because they possess this tremendous unleashed power that really is designed to be directed in the direction of the Torah. That's what that Gemara speaks about over there. Okay, but that's not our point right now. So Bar Kocha, when he had his first confrontation after 12 months, the Romans were able to recapture Yerushalayim, and Bar Kocha was forced to withdraw to the city called Beitar. Okay? Have you ever heard of Beitar? Not the Beitar from today, but Beitar is the great Beitar, and there the war continued for another 3.5 years, but here he was forced into a situation of siege, and this siege lasted, the siege of the city of Beitar lasted for 3.5 years. Okay? Now, unfortunately, the thing about Bar Kochba is that Bar Kochba became increasingly arrogant and complete, and increasingly believing in his own powers. So I'm not sure, there's a shocking medrash that says that when Bar Kochba and his soldiers would actually go out to battle, they would say to Hashem, "Don't help us, and don't help us, but don't get in our way either." In other words, we'll do it alone. Okay? That's what it says in the Midrash. By the way, there's a more favorable interpretation for that Midrash, but what we see generally is, the general idea is that his behavior, Bar Kochba's behavior, became increasingly erratic and despotic, and at this stage, Rabbi Akiva already realized that he'd made a mistake in his judgment about Bar Kochba, and he withdrew his support for Bar Kochba.
What made Bar Kochba go off the rails?
His success. He was. When you read the Midrashim, just how successful he was, right? And his power and his gvura, right? So, I guess this is a temptation for any. This is a temptation for anybody. And Bar Kochba was not up to that test. As I said before, he went off. He began quarreling with the sages. And there's a very famous Midrash. Midrash says like this: the city of Beitar was under siege for 3.5 years. Okay, was a major, one of the major Jewish concentrations. As a matter of fact, after the destruction of the temple, it was probably the single largest Jewish city in Judea. Very, very, very populous, very major city. It's one of the few cities that the Romans, big cities that the Romans left intact after they destroyed the second temple. Now, it says like this: it says in the Midrash that Bar Kochba had an uncle. His uncle was called Rabbi Elazar Hamadai. Rabbi Elazar Hamadai. We can describe Rabbi Elazar. And Rabbi Elazar says over here that the whole time that the siege was laid to, the Medrash says that all times, the 3 years that the siege was laid to Beitar, Rabbi Elazar was fasting the whole time. And the Medrash says that as long as Rabbi Elazar was fasting inside Yerushalayim, there was no way that the Romans could conquer Beitar. Actually, it says in the Medrash that after 3 years, Hadrian was ready to actually give up, and he was packing up and getting ready to go. And then somebody said to him, and this is an important insight into understanding the real power of the Jewish people, whenever you look at it, a person came up, a Jewish trader came up to Hadrian, and he says that the real power of the city of Beitar is not Bar Kochba, it is Rabbi Elazar HaMadoi. As long as he is fasting, as long as he is praying for the well-being of the city of Beitar, you cannot prevail over it. He says, if you listen to me, I have a nature for you. And this is the Medrash, that what he did was, that one time this traitor, when he went up, he went into the city of Beitar, and Rabbi Elazar was praying, and he went up and he whispered something in his ear. Okay? Now, of course, Rabbi Elazar was oblivious to this because he was traveling with great kavanah. And then somebody came and told him that Rabbi Elazar had been seen speaking to this traitor. So he called Rabbi Elazar, Bar Kochba called Rabbi Elazar over, and he said, "What are you doing? You're trying to, what's the word I'm looking for? Collaborate with the enemy? What did he tell you, that traitor over there?" So Rabbi Elazar said, "I don't know what you're talking about." And in a fit of rage, it says that Bar Kochba got very angry, lost his temper. He gave a kick to his uncle and he killed him. He killed Rabbi Elazar HaMadoi. Okay? That's what it says in the Medrash. Okay? So it says at that moment, right? Wait, I'll have to see if I write it down. I just want to quote to you the Medrash. Yes. At that moment, it says it's a Gemara, actually. The Gemara says that at that moment when Bar Kochba killed his uncle in a fit of anger, a fit of rage, a heavenly voice, a bas kol, a heavenly voice came out and said, you have killed Rabbi Elazar, who is the strong arm and the right eye of Israel. Therefore, your arm shall wither and your right eye will grow dim. In other words, this is a very important point to understand, that this is the real power of the Jewish people. The Medrash and the Gemara is telling us that if you want to know what was the secret of the success of the city of Beitar, it was one aged, righteous tzaddik who was constantly praying for the well-being of the city. We see that when he was gone, then the security of the city was overrun. Okay? And at that stage, then the Romans made their final attempt and they overran the city of Beitar. And the overrunning of the city of Beitar took place 63 years after the destruction of the temple, and it came on the day of Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. As a matter of fact, if you want to know one of the reasons why Tisha B'Av is the classic, the all time day of mourning of the Jewish people, we know that two of the reasons are because both temples were destroyed on Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. Yeah, one of the other reasons is because the destruction of the city of Beitar. The Rambam says that the destruction of the city of Beitar was a national tragedy on the scale of the destruction of the temple. The Romans overran the city of Beitar, and there was an absolute orgy of killing. The numbers in the Gemara describe millions and millions and millions of people being killed, rivers of blood overturning stones, right? How are you supposed to understand this? But the carnage and the destruction, it was Roman style, okay? By the way, the Roman authorities themselves, there's a famous Roman historian, he says he accounts for 1.5 million people killed in the city of Beitar, and 1,000 settlements waylaid in Judea, okay? So this was the idea right now that as a result in the aftermath of this, of Bar Kokhba's rebellion was finally defeated, right? After this, but this is only after Rabbi Elazar was no longer there to save the city of Beitar, and the destruction afterwards was absolutely, absolutely horrendous. Okay? And by the way, you may remember, I think we discussed it with whoever was here, that one of the part of the revenge that the Romans took is that they did not allow the dead of Beitar to be buried. Okay? Can you imagine? There were literally millions of corpses. The Romans would not allow the Jewish people to bury the dead of Beitar, and they left them lying wherever they fell. And they lied there for years until the days of Antoninus Pius. Antoninus Pius was the emperor who succeeded Hadrian several years later, and when she finally gave permission for the dead of Beitar to be buried. And we mentioned before that when this permission was given for them to bury the dead of Beitar, they found two miracles had taken place, and none of the bodies had decomposed. And as a result of this miracle, as son of gratitude that the Hashem had made a miracle that the bodies had not decomposed, and they finally had permission to bury the dead of Beitar, the sages composed a bracha called Hatov V'Hamitiv, and that is the fourth blessing that we say in Birkat Hamazon. They composed that blessing to commemorate the fact that the miracle that took place, that the dead of Beitar were left and had not decomposed, and the Jewish people were given finally the right to bury them. Just an observation. This blessing, Tov HaMeitiv, I can't remember where I saw it. This purpose was not just to give thanksgiving to Hashem, but to give the Chazal understood, the sages understood that this was like a turning point in Jewish history, meaning this was the final mission of any Jewish of hope of independence. In other words, this was the final utter blow to any idea of Jewish independence, and from now on the Jews would have to accept the idea of them being in dispersion and in exile. And the idea was to show them that if Hashem could do miracles and show chesed for the dead, that he could support the Jewish people through their exile as well. But I'm just pointing, this episode of Beitar and the defeat of Bar Kokhba was actually like a turning point. This was like a point right now where this was the death knell to any idea of Jewish independence until the Mashiach comes. Okay? Okay. Now, I'm not sure exactly, but I know that one thing I do know is that Antoninus became a king more than 6 years. Hadrian lived another 6 years after this episode, and Antoninus became the king after him. So it was at least 6 years. It could have been more. Exactly how many, I don't know. But you can imagine what kind of a miracle it was. Okay? So this was the famous rebellion of Bar Kokhba. This was the absolute disastrous, the destruction of the city of Beitar. It was a calamity for the Jewish people that was on a scale of the destruction of the temple. And this was really like a turning point for the Jewish people. This was it. There was no more hope for the Jewish people. The Jewish people would just have to accept the idea that they're in exile. Now, I want to speak right now about the aftermath of the revolt, and that is that the Romans hadn't yet finished with the Jewish people. They went on a countrywide orgy of destruction, decimating and annihilating the whole of the Jewish people, and they murdered and destroyed on a countrywide scale. And they basically, it says one of the Roman historians writes, famous Roman historian described that Eretz Yisrael, Judea, was reduced to the status of a barren desert. Amidbar Shamomo, right? Was like a barren desert. There was almost nothing left. It was basically the end of communal life in Judea. I just want to quote to you now just a little quotation from one of the great Jewish historians of the last century, someone called Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi. He says like this: the outcome of the war meant the complete destruction, meant the completion of the destruction. In other words, it was the completion of the destruction of the temple. The situation was of such gravity that in the whole of Jewish history, there is nothing to compare to it. Okay? I don't know, Rav Levi didn't live through the Holocaust. Chazal tell us in the Holocaust a third of the Jewish people were killed in the Holocaust. I have a feeling it could be that the numbers here were even greater proportionately than that. But until the time that he lived, he says this was the greatest calamity. There would never be a calamity like this in the story of the Jewish people until now. And then he writes as follows. This is the idea of encouragement. He says, only an eternal people like Israel, whose soul is in the Torah, and whose life is bound up and inseparable with it, only a people like this is capable of emerging from such a terrible and dreadful upheaval to rise again and revive to see the light again, and to develop skin and flesh and to become a light into the nations. Can I read that again? That's so beautiful. He says like this: the story of the Jewish people is rising up out of the pit of destruction, of getting up out of a destruction which had happened at any other time or any other place. No other nation could ever have come from such a blow, such an annihilation, such a being utterly shattered. And it hasn't even finished yet. But he says like this: only, if you don't mind, I just want to read it one more time. Only an eternal people like Israel, whose soul is in the Torah, and whose life is bound up and inseparable from it, only a people like this is capable of emerging from such a terrible and dreadful upheaval to rise again, to see the light and develop skin and flesh and become once again a light into the nations. Okay? This is only the Jewish people could do such a thing. And by the way, there's a pasuk that says, what's the story? It says, Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vakamah. Tzadik falls seven times and he gets up every single time. And this is the story of the Jewish people getting up out of the destruction and starting again. Okay, now after this, the Romans, they wanted to deal finally with the Jewish problem once and for all. And here, they boosted up, we said before, that they made a gzeira of shmadav, forbidding certain mitzvahs, right? And here now they made a crackdown, actually banning all the other kind of mitzvahs at all, hoping that by forbidding any other mitzvahs, all the other mitzvahs, the Jews would finally assimilate into the Roman world. In addition to the mitzvahs we mentioned before, here they forbade the wearing of tefillin, or reading the Megillah. These are all the cases we find in the Gemara: eating matzah, lulav, reading the Torah, and various other mitzvahs we find over here. So the mitzvah of sukkah and the mitzvah of tzitzit. Okay? I'll just tell you. Yeah?
The Romans read,
or in addition to all of the four things that we mentioned before that they forbade, now they began to forbid other mitzvahs as well. Okay?
They forbade other mitzvahs as well.
there was no. This was in Judea. There were still people that will see that even though communal life had been basically shattered, right? There were still Jews. You cannot annihilate the Jews. It can't be done. Okay. Yeah. Mistake. Yeah. Okay. There's a beautiful idea over here that the Gemara is speaking about. This period describes. The Gemara says we find that any mitzvah that the Jewish people in these times they accept upon themselves with great self-sacrifice, whatever mitzvah the Jewish people sacrifice themselves for, the Gemara says that this mitzvah they still do until this very day with simcha. Okay? In other words, any mitzvah that the Jewish people, there's a history that the Jewish people protect and preserve this mitzvah with their lives, they give up their lives for it, this mitzvah becomes, after what we call, it becomes embedded, entrenched in the Jewish neshama. And until this very day, the Jewish people still fulfill this mitzvah with joy. The Gemara gives an example of the mitzvah of Brit Milah. Brit Milah was always targeted by our presence as a mitzvah which represents Jewish uniqueness, and they forbade it. And it was a mitzvah that Jews traditionally gave up their lives in order to fulfill. And it's an amazing thing. The Gemara says that this is a mitzvah not only do Jews continue to do, but they do it with simcha. How do they do simcha? That whenever they do this mitzvah, they make a festive meal after the Brit Milah to show their joy at the mitzvah. You know, that's the reason why, you know, after they make a bris, you make a meal, festive meal. You know, it's called Sudas Mitzvah. You know why it is? To show your simcha. What's the expression of making a Suda? It's to show your joy and your happiness and the privilege of doing the mitzvah. Somebody told me that in Israel today, no matter how far away Jews are, there are two mitzvahs which even no matter how far away they still keep. One is Yom Kippur and doing Bris Milah on the eighth day. You see that this mitzvah became entrenched in the Jewish neshama, and this is because of the mysterious nefesh, the self-sacrifice the Jews showed for this particular mitzvah. Okay. One second. Okay. So anyway, the Romans, as we said before, they targeted these mitzvahs, but now they targeted the sages, and we mentioned the leading sage at this time was Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva was the head of one of the most illustrious groups of tzaddikim in the whole annals of Jewish history. And this is also a period which we, a particular event that we discuss in this time, and this is a topic called Asara Harugi Malchus, the 10 martyrs of the Roman government. Have you ever heard of the Asara Harugi Malchus? We mentioned these on Yom Kippur, and on Yom Kippur, where we speak about the Asara Harugi Malchus section of the Musaf Tefillah, and also on Tisha B'Av. If you want to see people, when people start crying on Tisha B'Av, and on Yom Kippur, it's when we mention the 10 martyrs who were killed by the Romans. These tzaddikim, the midrashim, the midrashim of this, the midrashim say that what happened was that the Hadrian was reading in the Torah, and he saw the part that their brothers sold Yosef as a slave, and then he came to the part of the Torah which says that kidnapping a Jew and selling him into slavery is a capital offense. So he called the sages and he says, what punishment was given to the 10 tribes? So they said, no punishment. So he said, I'm going to take you 10, and you 10 are going to receive the punishment for these 10 brothers who sold their brother. And because the Medrash says that since the time of the tribes, the 10 sons of Yaakov, there has never been a group of tzaddikim on a level of them until these 10 sages. They're called Rabbi Akiva and his friends. Rabbi Akiva was the leader of them, and these were the 10 martyrs killed by the Romans. And it was during this period. Some of them actually, there were two of them actually, it was in an earlier period. But this is something which was nothing short of a trauma for the Jewish people, because this was a destruction of the 10 of the greatest tzaddikim, Talmidei Chachamim. And this, until today, I have seen Jews weeping. Show one image when we read this part of the prayer either on Yom Kippur or on Tisha B'Av. But let me tell you first about the story about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was the agent's leading dominant sage of the Jewish people. We spoke about him before. Rabbi Akiva was nearly 120 years old, And it was 2 months after the defeat of Beitar, Rabbi Akiva was arrested, and he was held in jail for nearly a full year. Okay, and the Gemara tells us the following story about Rabbi Akiva. It's a very, very famous story. Actually, the story has two parts. Let's see what the Gemara says. The Gemara describes the story that one time, it says over here, that the Malchus, the Roman government, made a decree forbidding the public learning of Torah in the Jewish people. They forbade the learning of Torah. Came along a man called Papas Ben Yehuda. There's a man called Papas Ben Yehuda. He was a Talmud Chacham. And he found Rabbi Akiva, that he was gathering groups of people publicly, and he was publicly teaching them Torah. Yeah? Have you heard of this? Have you heard this Gemara? This is a famous Gemara, but listen to this. He said, Amalehi Akiva. He said to him, Akiva. By the way, from here we see that he was quite a big person, because you don't call the leader of the door by his first name unless you're a pretty big Talmud Chacham yourself. So he said to him, Akiva, are you not afraid? Are you not afraid of the government? So Rabbi Akiva said to him, I'll tell you a mashal. I'll give you a mashal. I'll give you a parable. He says over here, once upon a time, there was a fox, and a fox was walking along the banks of the river, and he saw fish that were darting along from place to place. Has anyone heard of it? You've heard of this, Gemara? Yeah? Well, is there someone who hasn't heard it? Everyone's heard it? You've heard it? Okay, listen to this. So Rabbi Akiva told, I'll tell you, there's a fox walking along the banks of the river, and the fox looked and he saw all the fish darting around from one place to the next. So Amalehem, the first fox, said to the fish, who are you running? Who are you fleeing from? So they said, we're running away from the nets that the people are trying to throw to just try to catch us. So the fox said to the fish, why don't you come up on the ground and we'll live together, you and me? That's what the fox said to the fish. Right? So the fish said to the fox, are you the fox, regarded as being the wisest, the smartest, the shrewdest of all the animals? You're not smart. As a matter of fact, you're stupid. He said, how much more so, if in a place where we need to live, in the water, right? That's our life. Our life is in the water. When we're living in the water, we're in danger. How much more so are we going to be in danger if we come up into a place where we have no life, right? So he said, that's a mashal. So what's are you trying to point? He's saying like this. Our life, it says, is the Torah, right? Our life is in the Torah. So he says, so too, we, who our life is in the Torah, when we learn the Torah, when we keep the Torah, because the Pasuk says, Ki hu chayecho lo'irach yomecha, it's your life, and it gives you length of days. Yeah? So he says over here, and even if in such a case, if we're keeping the Torah, we're in danger, what will happen to us if we'll stop keeping the Torah? Okay? That's what happens. So Rabbi Akiva, so the Gemara says, it was shortly thereafter, Rabbi Akiva was taken prisoner, was put in jail, was incarcerated, and they put him in the jail. And soon afterwards, they captured Papas Ben Yehuda, and they also placed him in a cell together with Rabbi Akiva. Right? So it says, Papas said to him, Akiva, happy are you, Rabbi Akiva, that you at least were taken prisoner for the sake of the Torah. And Papas was here in jail for, it doesn't say what he did, but for something worse, idle things. Okay. I'll come back to the continuation of this Gemara. But Rabbi Akiva was kept in jail. Rabbi Akiva, the great leader of the Jewish people, was kept in jail for one full year. Through this year, he still managed to make certain contact and was giving certain instructions to the Jewish people. There are a number of stories. The time doesn't permit me to describe them. And after a year in jail, Rabbi Akiva was taken out on Yom Kippur. And he was taken out, he was judged by Terence Rufus, who was the Roman governor of Judea, and in Caesarea, the Hippodrome, and he was publicly killed in the Hippodrome on Yom Kippur. Okay? The Chazal tell us that they were combing his flesh with iron combs. Okay? They were being tortured to death in the Kippur. It says in the Medrash that with every time they were combing his flesh, there was, I don't know what it is, stripping his flesh from him while he was alive. Rabbi Akiva is 120 years old, by the way. That's a very select group. We find some great Jewish leaders who lived to the age of 120. Moshe Rabbeinu, Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Akiva. It shows a certain greatness, a certain very select group. So it says that each time his flesh was being stripped, he would cry out, Tzadiku Hashem, Hashem is righteous. Hatzut Tomim Fael, the mighty one, he is perfect in all of his ways. Kol Drachov Mishpat, all his ways of justice, Tzadik V'Yoshehu. Okay? Now, listen to the Gemara. I want to continue that Gemara that I was reading before. Listen to what the Gemara says. This is a very, very moving Gemara. It says over here, at the time when they took Rabbi Akiva out to kill him, was on the day of Yom Kippur, it was a time for saying Kriyashim. In other words, it was the first time, it was the early time in the morning, and it was the beginning of the time to say Kriyashim. And they were combing his flesh with steel combs, and Rabbi Akiva was makabel on himself, accepted on himself the yoke of heaven, and he was saying Kriyat Shema. His Talmidim, his students, said to him, Rabbeinu, our teacher, even now, even in this situation, you're accepting on yourself all of the kingdom of heaven. He said to them, listen to these words. He said to them, all of my life I have been wondering about this pasuk. It says, V'hafta es Hashem elekecha, you will love Hashem, v'kol levavcha, with all of your heart. He says, I've done that. With all of your possessions, I've done it. What does it mean, b'kol nafshecha, with all of your soul? He says, even if they come to take away your soul, your life, for the sake of Hashem, he says, all my life I've been saying this pasuk. All my life I've been waiting, b'kol nafshecha, to be able to serve Hashem if necessary with my life. Even if Hashem comes to take away your life, yeah, I've always, all my life I was saying, when will this come to me? When will I have the opportunity, and I will be able to fulfill it? So he says, now that the moment has come, I'm going to fulfill it. This was the call, not that it'll take away your life. Rabbi Akiva was getting himself ready for this moment all of his life. I once heard a beautiful interpretation. What does it mean, all of his life? Meaning, if a person wants to get ready for this moment, we never ask for it. But by the way, it says that this is the greatest moment. A Jew who can withstand this situation, who gives up his life for Kiddush Hashem, this is a madrega, this is a level. This is a level that nobody else can achieve. So he says the Rebbe Akiva was waiting for it. And the Gemara says, the Malachim, the angels, they were crying out to Hashem. They're saying, this is the Torah, and this is its reward. Right? And Hashem said, a heavenly voice came out and says, Hashem silenced them. He says, this is what I have decreed. And then a heavenly voice came out and said, Ashrecha Rebbe Akiva, happy are you, Rebbe Akiva. You are invited, right? And it says, the Gemara says that there is no creature in the whole world that can approach in the world to come the level of Rabbi Akiva. This was the great level of Rabbi Akiva. This perfect person, we discussed the Midrashim last time that described the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. Moshe Rabbeinu saw Rabbi Akiva. He was shown a vision of Hashem of Rabbi Akiva. He was the greatest leader of his generation, and he showed him this moment as showing this eternal message for the Jewish people, for all generations, for self-sacrifice. I just want to finish with just one thing before I leave off, and that is, this is a beautiful, beautiful idea. It says like this: on this day when Rabbi Akiva was killed, it was on Yom Kippur. And that's why there's a special part of the liturgy which speaks about this. And this is the most most emotional part of the whole Yom Kippur davening when they're talking about Rabbi Akiva. The Jewish people, it's embedded in the Jewish neshama, this feeling for Rabbi Akiva. You can't explain it. It's just the word, I don't know, all you have to do is the feeling for Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, this great, the greatest of the sages, who lovingly gave up his life for this, and he was waiting for this moment. But listen to this. The Gemara says, on the day that Rabbi Akiva died, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was born. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was the greatest sage of his generation, who compiled the Mishnah, which is probably the most important life-saving aspects of the Jewish people. But the Gemara says, on the day that Rabbi Akiva died, Rabbi Yehuda was born. And about this we say a pasuk. The pasuk says, V'zorach HaShemesh U'ba HaShemesh. The sun rose and the sun set. On this we say that before the sun of one tzaddik sets, the sun of another tzaddik rises. Okay? So we see over here that here is this idea. We say, Hinei lo yanum v'lo yishan shemei yisrael. The Shemei Yisrael, the one who's protecting the Jewish people, never sleeps, he never slumbers. At this moment when the greatest tzaddik, the greatest leader, the greatest power, spiritual power of the Jewish people is being taken away. The next tzaddik is already being prepared. This is the sun of one tzaddik does not set until the son of the next tzaddik has already risen, is already ready. He's obviously not ready to take his place yet. We're going to have an interim period. But we say right now that in this time, at this Zerish Shmad, right, we say over here that this was a time which seems like a tremendous crisis for the Jewish people. But we say that even so, Hashem never, in the worst time, ever abandons the Jewish people. Hashem is preparing the salvation to come from somewhere else. And well, there's just one more detail right now. We're over time. I'll just finish that up next time before we go on.